Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Terry Dodd, and you have reached Walls in Our Minds. And I'm here with my co-host this evening, Kurt McKenzie, and Red Beckman will be on with us. We've got quite a lineup tonight. Kurt, before I turn you the floor and let you introduce your guests, I would like to open us in prayer. Father God, we are quite thankful this day, and we can see you moving. We can see you bringing people to repentance in this country. We can see that so many are hurting, and often that turns people to you, and sometimes that's what it takes. And we're sorry that we're so weak and silly in our ways that we don't respect you more and stay focused on you more. And sometimes it takes a situation like we're in this country right now to wake us up. I'm just praying that more and more people are waking up, Father, and we pray that your Spirit will touch hearts and minds and help us to see the truth of what's going on around us. We're especially thankful this day for what's gone on this morning in the state of Georgia, and that finally some truth has been entered into a court record regarding this usurper that is occupying our White House. And we're just thankful for what has happened. We pray for the protection of everybody involved, because we know that there have been lives lost by taking on this administration and the establishment that has been running our country for so long. And we just pray for the protection of these brave souls that are speaking out and taking action, and especially pray for the protection of that judge, Mr. Malahy. And we're just thankful again, and we ask that you be with us through this show. We're thankful for the guests we've got tonight. And we ask that your Spirit go before us in everything we do and say, and that what we do pleases you this evening. Thank you for our listeners. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. So, Kurt.
Terry.
You've got quite a lineup tonight.
I am very much looking forward to tonight's show.
Well, I'll just let you go. I don't know if Red's on with us or not. Red, are you on yet?
I'm on now.
Well, Red, Mr. Jim Beers is online with us and listening, so if you want to say hello, you just jump right in. But if it's okay, I'm going to let Kurt get this introduction done.
Yeah, well, I'm just real glad we're having Jim Beers. I have followed his tracks, I guess you'd say, for a long time, and so this is a real privilege.
Well, thank you.
Kurt?
Thank you.
Okay, well, listen, we're going to have a pretty good roundup tonight. We've got three people who could probably talk about almost all the aspects of the Endangered Species Act, but in order to try and make sure that we don't have a lot of redundancy, cover story without a lot of redundancy, I'm going to try and hold each of them to a particular part of this issue, at least for the first hour, and then in the second hour we could probably get a lot more interaction going. The first speaker will be Karen Budd Fallon, and the renowned, actually, constitutional attorney that is defending rural America. And I think she'll be talking about some of the legal perspective and what this act was intended to be versus what it's become. Secondarily, we'll have Ray Haupt speak. He is a retired forest ranger, and he actually had to – he's one of – on our side trying to do what's right for the community and for the people, but he's on the inside of the Forest Service making decisions as a line officer having to deal with this act. And I think he can give us kind of the inside perspective. And then finally, we'll have Jim Beers. And I've asked Jim to prepare some examples of what's happening with these listings across the nation and their impact on our country. So, Karen, if I could start with you, would you mind just giving a short background about yourself?
Sure. My name is Karen Bud Fallon. I am an attorney in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but my background really is not so much in the law, but is growing up as a fifth-generation rancher on a family-owned ranch in Big Piney, Wyoming. Growing up on a ranch, you really start to understand the culture, the people, and a true love and respect for the land. When people talk about how environmentalists are trying to stop use of the land, they don't even know what it means. The true environmentalists are the people that are out there living on the land and working on the land every day. If we weren't careful with the land, if we didn't care for species, if we didn't care for this environment, we would have put ourselves out of business years and years and generations ago. So that really is my background. My goal in this whole fight is so that my kids may have a chance to go back to that ranch someday. That's why I think it's so important to enforce the Constitution and to really look at some of these statutes, because if not, our children are never going to have the same chance as we are.
So let's talk tonight about the Endangered Species Act. This seems to be, you know, I've in a short period of time that I've really studied this in any kind of detail in the past few months, I've almost come to realize this thing is like a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, it's causing more havoc to this country than an enemy with Tommy bombs could do in terms of its impact. So perhaps we start at the beginning. Tell me, give me the history of this act and what it was intended for originally.
Well, I think the act was originally passed with fairly benign intentions. It was originally passed in the 70s when the environmental movement sort of took hold of this country, and you had lots of awareness growing about how people interacted with the environment. You had people then sort of jumping on the bandwagon of, we've got to protect the environment. We have to make sure we have clean air and clean water, which is something that everyone supports. And so you have a series of acts passed, one of which was the Endangered Species Act. I read years later a quotation by Richard Nixon, who signed the act, that said if he would have known what the act was going to turn into, he would have never signed it in the first place. Because originally the act was to look at true threatened or endangered species and then figure out a way to get them off the list. It was to look at whether humans were causing an adverse impact and then deal with that issue. And so the act was really based on species and management and not what it is now, which is simply paperwork and the loss and stopping of production and land use.
So the act had kind of a limited goal. I think that you told me that it actually had embedded in it a fair number of limitations, and it also had a sunset clause. Was that correct?
Yes. It also, the original act talked about how it was going to work with local communities, how it was going to be incentive-based. All of that stuff has sort of been read out of the act. The act is actually, the funding for the act has run out years and years ago, but Congress just keep putting line items in budget without actually ever reauthorizing or renewing the substance of the act itself.
And spend a little time then. So why don't you give us first off, why don't you tell us kind of how its interpretation is today in realistic terms? What is it? You know, I think most of us, I certainly, it was me, and I think most of the public have been led to believe, and this is what I think the act was originally explained to be, was a protection against species that were about to go extinct. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, that is truly what the original act was intended for. It looked at species like the grizzly bear and the bald eagle and determined that those important types of species should be protected. At least that's what the act was intended to do in 1979 and when it was originally passed. The problem is now is that the act has really almost become a paper exercise in spending money and in funding environmental groups. Under the Act, Congress set some very short time frames in which to consider species. And I believe that's because Congress didn't think that we were talking about very many species that needed protection. So the Act set certain time limitations. For example, if you or any individual files a petition to list a threatened or endangered species, the Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to respond in 90 days. If you're talking a limited number of species, I'm sure that's possible. The problem is now groups like Center for Biological Diversity and Wild Earth Guardians and the Sierra Club are petitioning to list thousands of species each year. Even if the Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to, there is simply no way that they can get through that paperwork. And so if the Fish and Wildlife Service waits 91 days to respond to a petition, an environmental group can sue the federal government, they get paid their attorney's fees, it forces this huge, vicious cycle, it takes taxpayer money, funds environmental groups, and we just keep adding species to the list. Once a species is added to the list, the problem becomes that the Act prohibits any take of a species. And the word take is a term of art that is hugely defined in the Endangered Species Act, meaning that you cannot harm, shoot, harass, or attempt to do any of those things, or adversely modify its habitat. And so as soon as a species gets on a list, then, instead of focusing on the needs of the species and how to get the species off the list, the focus is how do we stop land use because of the harsh provisions and penalties in the Endangered Species Act. And so in my opinion, it's not protecting anything, assuming you believe that the Act itself is valid and assuming that's what the public wants to spend public money on. It's not even doing that, because we're just simply spending money adding species to the list and not money on recovery plans or truly considering what the needs of the species are and how to get them off the list.
Now, in my short experience here with Siskiyou County and looking into what's going on with the coho salmon, I came across the fact that, you know, they're listing the coho salmon. What I've discovered is coho salmon is pretty plentiful. They have successfully put it in reservoirs throughout the country. They successfully put them in the Great Lakes. And as I've asked questions of you and Ray and others, I'm becoming to understand that the Act is currently being interpreted is not that the species is going extinct, but the goal here is to restore a native species to its original numbers in its original location with its original and natural habitat, irrespective of whether it's going extinct or not. And under that kind of a perspective, then it's basically an anti-civilization act. If you decide, you know, there's plenty of buffalo still in the United States, but if you decide they have to be on the original range, on the original habitat, you know, you can wipe out a bunch of cities. If you discover that there's a certain grass that existed in L.A. before the city was built, and now we have to restore that grass or that lizard, wipe out L.A. or Las Vegas. It seems to me that the way that the Act, if I'm correct in understanding how the Act is currently being interpreted, it inevitably is going to lead to the consequence of the destruction of the progress that we've made in this country. Is that fair?
I think that is fair. And, in fact, the new Obama administration policy redefining what a, quote, significant portion of its range, unquote, is going to make it worse. Under the old policy, if a species was plentiful in one area, but there were few numbers in another area, the Fish and Wildlife Service could just list the species in the area where there were a few numbers. Now, under this new policy that the Obama administration is taking comments on, if a species is lacking in just a portion of its range, the Obama administration intends to list the species in its entire range, even including in areas where the species is plentiful. And so I view this as much more of a land grab and a human control issue rather than a protection of the species issue, which is what the Act was originally at least billed to be to the public and to the president by the Congress.
The other broadening of this thing seems to me to be that what is a species? I mean, I would think dog, cat, you know, cow, fish, you know, bird. But it seems to me they're taking the definition down to a level of, you know, whether this particular, you know, little tiny 3-inch fish has a black speck on its tail versus one that has a white spot in its tail. Is that, maybe I'm overstating, I don't know, but is that kind of true? They're broadening it, what the definition of the threshold of a species is being lowered to the point that almost everything has got some kind of a problem here.
I am certainly not a scientist, but I did ask some geneticists one time, and they told me the problem was in the genetics community with whether they called them lumpers or splitters. And lumpers were people that took genetic traits and put them together so that a black spot and a white spot, the colors didn't matter as long as it was a spot, they were the same species. And a splitter would be is somebody that said, oh, no, they're absolutely different species. And it looks like now the geneticists and the scientists who believe in splitting up these species seem to have taken over. And then you add distinct population segments, which is where if you've got a species that lives in one area, for example, they do this a lot with fish. If you've got a fish that lives in one creek and the same fish lives in another creek, but the creeks don't intersect, then they can list them both as separate, distinct population segments.
This broadening and reinterpretation of the original act, has that been accomplished? Has it been as a result of new legislation?
Well, there have been some changes to the act, but most of it, in my opinion, is caused by the courts, particularly the Ninth Circuit Court, which is in California, and then through agency policy and through agency regulations, particularly, for example, like this new policy on determining whether something is within a significant portion of the range or not. The Obama administration is claiming that that's based on court precedent, but based on what they claim is a requirement by the Ninth Circuit, they are now going to make the same requirements throughout the nation.
Okay, now, before I move on to Ray, is there any other thought you'd like to make along these lines before I move on?
Well, at this point, Congress has decided that it needs some oversight on the Endangered Species Act. At least the House of Representatives have. And so the House of Representatives is starting to hold oversight hearings, and they are going to be really looking at the act. I think that the act has been so blown out of proportion that I believe Congress needs to seriously take stock as to whether this act is having its intended consequences. And I believe the public really needs to decide if we can afford to continue interpreting the act the way we are now.
Okay. Now, Ray, can I go ahead and ask you the same thing? We just take a moment to give us a little background about yourself.
Sure. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'd like to start off, I guess, by saying that my professional training is as a professional in natural resources management. I have a concentration of study in forestry, which makes me a forester. I have some aftergraduate work that I've done in both engineering and in ecology as well. And beyond the education piece, I currently am a adjunct professor at a community college. I teach forest science classes there. Retired 2 years ago from the United States Forest Service. On my retirement, I was a district ranger. Was a district ranger for the past 12 years prior to retirement, and prior to that, for about 21 years, worked as a forester. Across the nation, I worked on the East Coast, worked on the West Coast, and several places. I've actually worked in Siskiyou County three times during my career and chose it back in the 70s as a place I wanted to retire. With all that experience and everything else, I guess the I nearly had to become a paralegal, so to speak, in the last 12 years of my career, trying to make legal decisions as a line officer for the Forest Service, to, either in timber sales, recreation, or all the other programs associated with it. So I spent, you know, a bulk of my time researching law, researching policy, dealing with planning experts and teams of lawyers. And, of course, that was even intensified here on the West Coast because I worked within the boundaries of the Northwest Forest Plan.
Okay. Now, before I go on, I want to point out one thing you mentioned. Make sure everybody understands this point. It's something I was learning, too. In every one of these agency decisions, you know, there's an agency that wants to build a bridge, and then there's regulatory agencies saying, no, you can't do this, can't do this, can't do this. But at the end of the day, the agency that wants to do the project eventually makes the final decision, and that's the line officer. And the line officer is legally liable for that decision, and you were a line officer, so it was your signature on the line, and people need to understand that there is accountability in the system once we understand it. And Ray, as being one of those people, was in the situation. You really, truly had to understand this. So, Ray, why don't you give us your inside perspective of dealing with the Endangered Species Act?
Sure. Let me give you a little bit of a synopsis, I guess, in the decision-making process. And when I speak of decision-making, I'm talking about who puts their name on the final document as approval. And that would be me within my delegated authority up to a certain level of project anticipated impact. And then my immediate supervisor above me, who's less than a half an hour away, the forest supervisor, but I would do all the work and everything else and pass it on for signature with recommendation. during the process, the process typically starts with a analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act. And it's kind of interesting to hear Karen talk about the Endangered Species Act, but the National Environmental Policy Act was passed first in, I believe, 1970, and then 1973 came along the Endangered Species Act. What happens that in the application of the Endangered Species Act and the way it was particularly written, it actually preempts some of the public process pieces that were intended in NEPA. One of them in particular is public input and development of alternatives. The Endangered Species Act will typically take those off the table as not being feasible because even though the public may want something done through the consultation processes with the ESA, they may not be permissible. So when you start this process, the first thing that starts also is a parallel process of consultation with the regulatory agencies. Now, I worked for the Forest Service, who by definition is not a regulatory agency. We didn't regulate anything of another agency or outside the boundary of the actual national forest. Our main role was to implement what Congress intended, either vegetation projects, firefighting, fire projects, community projects that were important to sustain a community lifestyle of some sort, grazing, on and on, those things that depend on a natural resource base. The consultation process that begins as part of those analysis starts with biologists discussing the Endangered Species Act and what habitat may be present within the project area. The line officer is trying to conduct both processes at the same time, trying to talk with the public, see what the public wants in a project, but then is also often cut off through the Section 7 process as options are taken off the line officer's plate in development of the action alternative. When you get down to the decision itself, Kurt asked me in a former interview about the difference between NEPA and the difference between ESA. The big difference is, and it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek comment, but it's also sad, is that in the decision-making process, you can pretty much ignore public comment without legal implications associated with that, other than an appeal or something like that, and a blatant ignorance of that. But what the public really wants done is preempted by the penalties to the line officer under the Endangered Species Act. For instance, if the public wants something done and it doesn't conform to the consultation process and it's deemed that the decision maker is taking liberties that the regulatory agency doesn't agree with, by signing that document and implementing the project can be outside the bounds of the issued take that Karen was talking about, and be subject to a $10,000 fine. There's only several things in the decision-making process for which a line officer can be held personally accountable, unless they're outside the scope of their job. One is the Endangered Species Act with its penalties. The other is takings cases under the Constitution. Those come up fairly regularly in mining activity where you have a clash of private property being the gold and the analysis process under NEPA and ESA.
So is it fair to say, maybe I can summarize a little bit see if I can simplify this in my head, is that when you have an Endangered Species Act, you inherently are coming under NEPA as well, and the Endangered Species Act requires you as the line officer trying to do a project to coordinate with all these regulatory agencies, and the dialogue begins between agencies. And this dialogue is, for the most part, invisible to we the people. We don't even know that's going on, but in this process, you are liable if you violate that for these huge fines or a lawsuit, and this dialogue is going on and shaping the outcome and making some predetermined decisions, removing options from the table, even before it gets to the next phase, which is coordination that everybody is talking about, which is under NEPA, where if a local government entity understands its rights, it can demand to be involved and have its issues heard and its planning brought in, and the federal government has to respond to that. And then the final phase is public input, kind of a three-phase process, but in the last two, in coordination or public input, it's a slap on the hand but not a fine. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, it's the difference between a monetary penalty versus maybe a short loss of credibility, so to speak. Yeah, you're much better at putting that together than I was, Kurt. More eloquent.
Actually, I'm learning it from you, so I'm just I'm always a synthesizer, is what I am. So it's something for the communities to understand and for the people to understand the entire decision-making process. Now, what is your perspective as a line officer, somebody on the inside that's trying to make a decision? I know from everything I've heard, Ray, that you were one of the people who was actually trying to make decisions that were favorable, you know, the original intent. They were favorable to the community. You weren't trying to destroy these industries. You were trying to do a good job. What is it that's actually shaping the landscape here when it comes to interpretations of a Endangered Species Act?
Most of what shapes the decisions, shapes the policies, shapes the direction of the way an agency may be going, quite frankly, is the threat of lawsuit. You and I have discussed this a bit before, where you have this balancing act as a line officer. Your small communities, particularly in Siskiyou County, depend a great deal on the raw product coming off the national forest for the basic economy or engine driver of the local economies here. So you're saddled with this: do I do everything I can possibly do to get a product on the market at the expense of not being able to get through the process and be sued? Or do I somehow balance this with what I might squeak through without litigation, compromising just about everything in, you know, that I know from a scientific perspective to get some product on the market in a minute way? So it's quite a balancing act, and you know, it's fraught with pitfalls. The consultation process can turn around on you on a dime, come out of nowhere when a piece of science, so-called science most of the time, is published, making your project invalid, and all of a sudden you have to back up and reanalyze or redesign. That's very frequent in the process as these courts pass down different perspectives on what they think habitat is for certain species, and it kind of changes over time and kind of pulls the rug out from under you, even toward the end of the process sometimes.
Now, you were saying to me, I know the you as line officer have a certain budget. I mean, you have so many dollars to work with, and effectively you're trying to make the best use of those monies. Now, when you talk about product and forest, what you're talking about is that for people who may not be from rural America to understand is that 65% or so of the western United States is in this thing called public lands, where you have federal agencies that are involved, and that, you know, whether it's trees or it's fishing or it's mining, raising cattle, almost all these communities depend in some part on this kind of relationship with the lands that are surrounding, which they have some federal control over them. And so it becomes an issue. So what you're talking about product, you mean trees that are being authorized by the federal government to be taken from the forest for the industry to go ahead and utilize, right?
That's correct. And the other thing to keep in the forefront of your mind, it, the there is a contract, so to speak, with the counties in these rural areas. You have to remember that public land is not subject to taxation from a property tax perspective. So the only way that the county can get money for roads and schools, unless Congress appropriates it, as it has had to do since the timber decline of the early 90s, is there's a portion of the receipts off of timber that goes back to the county specifically for the support of both roads and schools.
Okay. Now, so you have this budget, and out of this budget you have to deal with everything, and I guess under your budget, you, if there was a lawsuit that came out of your budget and came out of the projects and things that you wanted to do for the community and so forth. So I guess that what it matters is the personalities of the people who are forest rangers. How do they deal with this, you know, in kind of a, I know it would be very person to person, but in general, how do you feel is the general way that the line officers deal with this threat of lawsuit?
You know, truthfully, it depends a lot on personality. I was heavily litigated, and so was the predecessor of me before I got here, largely because of the area we work is very litigious, so to speak. Instantly, everything instantly jumps to court. It's kind of the nature of where we sit. The other part of that, too, is both he and I tried as best we could to fulfill the mission of the agency. Now, it would have been just as easy as some line officers do to kind of ignore that mission and, you know, if you produce, you produce. If you don't produce, you don't produce. My predecessor and I happen to believe that we were part of the community, and it was our ultimate goal to serve the American public, and that wasn't the special interests that were jerking us around.
So the lawsuits that you were coming after you wasn't the community; it was, in fact, this environmental groups.
It was, yes.
Okay. Now, if I assume that you were probably two examples of the people that really would stand up and. Even when you do stand up, you have this counterbalancing issue of your budget only goes so far, and you have to decide how to use your money. So even there, you have this balancing act. I was assumed that a forest ranger that really didn't want to have any stress in their lives and so forth, just kind of don't make waves, they would actually appease the people who are making the threat of litigation. Even if they didn't believe that there was merit to the litigation, they would just appease that in order to get along.
In order to, I don't know about get along, but in order to not make waves and you know, make their job and life easier, truthfully. You know, I don't know any ranger that goes into that job that doesn't have some stress from personnel management
mm-hmm.
To speak of. But the environmental side of this issue can be almost insurmountable at times.
Now, in your perspective, from your experience inside, it's this litigation that's forming the policies as much as anything else. We've had a separate discussion about the Equal Access to the Justice Act, but why don't you just briefly explain how that's being used by the environmentalists?
Sure. What I, you know, one of the things that in my background is I have been responsible for the recovery of an endangered species, worked in that, but we had I happened to be in a niche place in the United States that didn't have litigation. And in a matter of a few years, we turned a population around. It happened to be red-cockaded woodpeckers through the use of science. But science is prevented from being used in a professional manner by a lot of these lawsuits because suddenly the consultation process becomes a test of law, not what's best for the habitat requirements for a particular species or what's best for a particular biology of a species. It's reactive to what's going on in the courts. Frequently, the litigation that I was experienced was in the administrative law body, and it was against whether or not, you know, some cases there was one lawsuit that was against whether a form was filled out correctly. So it was whether the decision was arbitrary and capricious under the law because there was some insufficient data, not because it was so much related to a consequence environmentally on the landscape.
Okay, but the Equal Access to Justice Act allows basically people to reclaim,
correct,
if you will. They could sue the federal government, and then if they win or they settle, they get paid by the federal government. So essentially the federal government is paying people, in effect, after the fact, to sue the government. And
that's correct. That's
yeah.
correct. And,
okay.
and under that, you know, lawsuits that even the government wins, often they end up, well, always, they end up reimbursing the suing party for the litigation. The interesting part of that as well, too, is most people maybe in the audience think about lawsuits. Your tree knocks down your neighbor's fence and you get sued for the cost of the fence. Well, in that body of civil law, there's harm done, and you have to show harm to collect in a civil case like that. In a government case where it's an administrative case against a decision, you don't have to show harm. All you have to show is that you were engaged in the process all along and you disagree with it at the end.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that one of the things that comes up through the process is new science, quote, science, is coming into the process. And I think I have a realization a lot of that now is not science anymore, but politics. And you have a mm-hmm. training in what you do. You know, educational background, you practice this stuff. Were you ever in a situation where, quote, new science was being brought to bear that you knew was false?
Sure.
And as a line officer, what can you do about it? Can you just toss it out, or how does that work?
Well, I can try. The agency does take some of that stuff on and writes rebuttals to it. There were several of those in recent history that kind of turned some peer-reviewed science upside down. And in order to understand this issue, you have to know, you know, for the listeners, they can go and look up the scientific method, and that's the peer-reviewed hard science that decisions under the law, under the Endangered Species Act, were initially geared toward. There's a clause in the act that says you'll use the best available science. Not any science. The best available science. And that gets to the heart of peer-reviewed. I wish they'd have put peer-reviewed in there. It would have cleared it up a bit. But some of this stuff even comes from somebody writing a letter that gets published somewhere in an article or a journal, and all of a sudden now it's science that you have to react to. On its very face, that's not science from a scientific method. And what's more than difficult with most of the science is it's very rare that the science related to the project or the species you're dealing with is specific enough to address the environmental complexities of where that project might be. In other words, you can't take science from the East Coast a lot of time and apply it to the West Coast situation. You have completely different ecosystems.
Okay. Now, there's one other point that probably before we go on to Jim, I'd like to have you address that, and I know it's one of the major issues you see in the landscape here, and I think you called it the single species issue.
That's correct.
Why don't you go ahead and take a moment?
Unfortunately, and I don't believe this was in the initial intent of the act, because I was one of the first students in college to be trained in the act when I went to college. That was about my era, the early 70s in school. What happens is in the listing, there is a critical habitat designation for that particular species. And what it typically does is it narrowly defines what's optimum for that species. It doesn't discuss how that species lives within the context of a broader watershed or a broader landscape. It only focuses on its specific requirement for that individual species. So it sets it aside as if it doesn't interact with the rest of a functioning ecosystem at the detriment of every other animal and plant species within it. Forest ecology doesn't work that way. Everything's connected for a reason. It's dynamic. It's never held in what's called a static state. In other words, I often explain it, holding old growth in perpetuity is like loving your mother at 80, expecting her to live to be 150. The world doesn't work that way, but yet the Endangered Species Act does, because it was written by lawyers who don't understand the dynamics of ecosystems.
So essentially, when an animal gets listed, effectively the way the whole dynamics work then is basically every other species is ignored. If the impact on the water supply is pretty much ignored, I think increasingly I see that the communities are ignored. I mean, pretty much everything else is ignored and subdued to this, and what changes are made for this one particular species may be detrimental to the economy, detrimental to other species, the watershed, mining, private property rights, but none of that seems to matter.
No, you're correct, because the preeminent importance is that species alone. And often we end up having prescribed habitat requirements that to perpetuate that from a peer-reviewed science perspective on a particular landscape, they may not be sustainable. In other words, holding something at an artificial, like on the Klamath National Forest, holding something at an artificially high crown closure predisposes it to stand replacing fire. That's not the way our ecosystem works, but it's a one-size-fits-all description of what that habitat should be at the detriment of everything else around it. It often places such dysfunction in the ecosystem that it places one endangered species against another. As it does here in the Klamath, it places owls against fish on the same landscape where high densities of the trees that tend to form those are real water users locally here that reduce the flow to the streams that's required to keep the endangered species alive.
Keep the fish alive.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim, let me go ahead and turn to you next. Why don't you go ahead and take a moment and give a brief background about yourself?
I'm Jim Beers. I'm retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service now for, I guess, about 11 years. And I was forced to retire at the time back at the end of the Clinton administration. And over the 32 years that I spent with the Fish and Wildlife Service in North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, New York City, and Washington, D.C., and I did a lot of traveling to Europe for him, too. I was a wetlands biologist, special agent, wildlife biologist, congressional fellow. And I worked for the Utah Game and Fish Department while I was going to school at Utah State University. I've got a bachelor's in wildlife resources, and I've got a master's degree in public administration. And I worked in Washington for my last 20-some years. So I've got a good overview of things. And I'm probably about 10 years older than Ray, and when I came to work and went through college in the early 60s, and I came to work in the late 60s after I spent 4 years in the Navy. I was at a different part of this change that Ray was talking about, and I saw when I came into Washington in law enforcement work back in the early 70s, how they were drafting the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Endangered Species Act, and at the same time rewriting the migratory bird treaties to give far greater authority to the federal government, and EPA was taking off, and we were coming out on the side of stopping whaling around the world, and it was the first glimmerings. I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back on it, there were the first glimmerings of these federal agencies in Washington coming under the control of and being infiltrated by, whatever the right words are, these environmental people and animal rights people that today we take it for granted that they sort of run these agencies, and they're a large part of this interchange that Karen and you were talking about between the law and the courts and the policies and the regulations, changing things. And I would disagree very strongly that this has been sort of a natural progression that just happened because of certain courts or certain scientific findings or anything. I think the darn Endangered Species Act and the way it's gone and what it's done has been a calculated national and international attempt in this country to give the central government far greater authority over everything to do, particularly with rural America, and to at the same time diminish state and local governments and their authority and their funding and push them out of the way. And then what that's resulted in is sort of environmental and animal rights philosophies being implemented behind the scenes and with great interchange between the bureaucrats in Washington, these organizations from the Defenders of Wildlife to the Humane Society, World Wildlife Foundation, to the UN staff and others who have meetings and change jobs and move back and forth. They know what they're doing, and it's all sort of a calculated thing from the Arizona Strip, which is essentially getting closed down to everything, for instance.
Yeah, let me jump in here a bit, because I have a specific way I like to kind of approach these as we now. The thing that I really would like, Jim, for you to do is I think that it'll be interesting for people to realize that, you know, we may have heard about an endangered species here or there, but just how pervasive this is, how many there are across the country and their impact. So I'd like to kind of group them, if you don't mind, though. So why don't you talk about the impact? You know, rural America, we think it's a rural American problem. It's not. Rural America, for example, is where all of our energy comes from. So why don't you talk about how, give some specific examples of listings and how it's impacting energy.
Well, the energy issue went all across the country, all the way from Pennsylvania to the Dakotas and Montana down to Arizona, southern Utah. There are large dimensions of the Endangered Species Act being used selectively in cooperation with everything from wilderness declarations to water rights seizures to national fire policies, easements, and government purchases. And it's difficult to be very specific about the number of acres or the dollars of energy foregone in the ground due to the Endangered Species Act. But some examples of what's going on to date, you know, back when the ESA first came in, there was the big conflict about the snail darter fish, a small, tiny fish in Tennessee that was declared to be endangered. And at the same time, by doing that, a large dam could not be built. And it went on for years, the back and forth, and they couldn't build the dam. And this darter, which was a very ubiquitous fish, to be honest with you, and it really had no more business in anybody's mind being endangered, but that wasn't the point. The point was, like so many of these declarations of these fish, was to stop an energy development here, in this case the Tellico Dam. And as Congress just recently did with wolves up in Montana and Idaho, Congress passed a specific law exempting the Tellico Dam and the Snail Darter Declaration from being impediments to one another, and they went ahead and built the dam, just like they've now turned authority over wolves up in Montana and Idaho, limited though it is, back to the states because it was an irresolvable issue. But we've got the down in Texas and New Mexico where there's a great, in West Texas and eastern New Mexico, where there's a lot of oil drilling and there's a lot of livestock coincidental with that oil drilling. There's now claims about dune sagebrush lizard being listed, a small 3-inch lizard that, because of where it lives and what little bit of information they've got about it, they're going to have to modify or stop drilling on a lot of rigs, and they're not going to be able to put more rigs out there to get oil up out of the ground. What the total impact of that is really not quantifiable, like so many of these things. It's like the attempt right now to put the sage grouse in as an endangered or threatened species under the Act, which would cover large areas of sagebrush flats and that in Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, that have sage grouse on them or could have sage grouse on them. And sagebrush, which is an important part of sage grouse habitat, is itself a disturbance plant. And what it amounts to is the federal government would have to tell people, not only can you not drill for oil out there, it's going to be difficult to get a permit to go through those enormous millions of acres of public land and private land if they list the sage grouse, which currently is hunted in nearly all of those states, by the way. There are that many of them, but be that as it may, there never are a lot of them. But that they would stop any new oil drilling out there, as well as doing away with a lot of the grazing, because the government and the science that they will gin up, and they will gin up the science that they need by getting the right universities with the right professors, just like they go to the Ninth Circuit Court, as Ms. Bud Fallon pointed out rightly, to get the right decision. They'll work it out with the right university to get the right professor that doesn't want oil drilling going on out there, thinks that cattle don't belong in the public land, and that hunters shouldn't be shooting these birds, to come up with findings that show that it's very important that they not be disturbed in the fall and that their numbers be allowed to come back. And in the meantime, we'll stop all the grazing here. We'll do away with grazing over there, and it'll never return. It's like spotted owl restrictions and a whole bunch of other things.
Well, let me stick to energy for a second, because I really want to make sure people really fully understand. So the point what we're saying here is, and I'm going to simplify, Jim, a lot of what you're saying, is a snail daughter prevents a dam in Tennessee. The dunes sagebrush lizard at this point in time is perceptively going to threaten oil production in Texas. We have the issue where we have a coho salmon in Siskiyou County that may result in the destruction of 4 hydroelectric dams. Have you mentioned the Arizona Strip? You want to give a brief moment about that?
I can do that, sure. And as we talk about these things, recognize that you just mentioned the sagebrush lizard, and I mentioned its implications. As they consider listing them, the federal government is out there taking cooperative, coerced agreements from the oil drillers and from the livestock people to stop doing this and to not do that way and to stop doing other things, under the impression that they're going to be exempted from any declarations coming. So there's a lot of taking of property rights and energy development going on, even as we talk, that you don't see on the surface, and it's pretty big. But we can talk about the Arizona Strip being, if you imagine the map of Arizona, the northwest corner of that state, pretty significant area, which is already in the National Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management and a big wilderness area, and pretty much all federal lands tied up in there. They've got endangered species in there, like the desert tortoise and some others. I don't have a list in front of me of what species are in there. But what they're doing right now with that strip is trying to go even further than what the wilderness area did here and what the National Park Service does by regulation and what the Endangered Species Act does for the desert tortoise, and really close that area down to such a degree that there will not be any uranium mining allowed in there. And that's a very large source of our uranium here in the United States.
It's 50% of our country's uranium supplies will potentially be shut off. So there goes nuclear energy.
That's exactly right. And coal development and even power lines passage through there will be made almost impossible. It's the natural progression of so many of these things working together and finally interlocking. It's going on in the forests in Oregon. It's going on in the grazing lands up in Montana. It's going on in the private lands down in southern Florida. It's going on in North Carolina and Arkansas and a lot of other places where a whole bunch of these different movements, and I use the word movement lightly, we're really talking about government programs and government bureaucracies working in consort to do what the Arizona Strip shows us so much more of America is going to become, even without the outright government land ownership that's going on there right now.
Okay, and let's take as the last example of energy. So really, let's get this nailed. So we're talking about hydropower. We've been talking about oil in some places. We've been talking about uranium. The Bakken oil fields, and most people aren't aware of this, but I think it's North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, somewhere in that area. We have more oil in this country tenfold than we have the entire Middle East, and nobody's been told this, but this was a discovery within the past, I think, 15 years. Talk about what's happening in the Endangered Species Act in the Bakken oil fields.
Well, I was up there. In fact, I've been up there twice in the last year hunting up in that where the Bakken field is, and I'll be back up there this spring in that area doing some hunting too. And what's going on is that it's mostly private property in western North Dakota and in eastern Montana, a little bit down into South Dakota in that corner of Wyoming. It's called the Bakken Field, and it's mostly private property out there, and there's an enormous amount of oil development going on. I was very impressed with what I've seen out there, and I've spent a lot of time in the last year and a half, 2 years, driving around the back roads out there looking for birds. And what the Endangered Species Act is being used for out there is on private property to try to use the sage grouse, which there are sage grouse out there, as perhaps a good wedge on that. And another recent idea, which is their idea to restore the free-roaming buffalo to that area, which will not only impede oil development, that it'll make transportation on roads just driving to and from your ranch very difficult and dangerous. It'll be bad for livestock grazers. It'll be bad for private property. And the wolf, which is endangered in Montana, is more and more seen now in eastern Montana. So the federal government is going to have some say about that, particularly in North Dakota as the wolves tumble in there from Montana. And it's a difficult thing to describe totally to most people that don't know about your state authority over all fish and game and wildlife and plants, wild plants in the state. But in the federal government, using the Endangered Species Act, what you wind up with is we've got, in most states, very, very weak state fish and wildlife agencies. They're mostly beholden to the federal agencies for more and more of their money.
You might want to, before we get into open discussion about these things, I really want to try and get out these examples. So please kind of try and limit this. We're running out of this time for this segment. So here's what I want you to do is basically just kind of be brief about this, and we'll talk about the open discussion later. So let's take food. Give some examples of how this is affecting food in the United States.
Well, you look at the San Joaquin Delta there in California and what the Delta smelt has done to enormous hundreds of thousands of acres of some of the most productive farmland in the United States. It's completely shut down. You can look at what's going on at Klamath, again, with hundreds of thousands of acres being taken out of production and power becoming more expensive for what's left in production, and irrigation water disappearing up there with the declarations about suckers and salmon. And you look down in southern Florida, the sugar cane areas down there, and what the Florida panther and the black bear listing is doing down there to farming and farming output. It's all bad. And if we look at other things that have been used to cut back on farm and animal production, we can look at what wolves are doing to the beef industry. We can look at what the masked bobwhite has done down in Arizona, what the jaguar is doing now to cutting down on public land grazing, what the desert tortoise has done to cut down on public grazing. It's you add it all up, you look at spotted owls, you look at, as far as forestry, but you look at red-cockaded woodpeckers in the south, ivory-billed woodpeckers that have been extinct for 60 years. And what they've done to farming areas in the south is they thought they could find them. They've taken easements and federal land purchases that have taken more and more land out of production. We're talking about millions of acres coming out of production. There's a large military artillery base in eastern Colorado that wants to double in size and take up about 1.5 counties. And when they do that, they'll take that out of production for cattle. It's going on all over the country. And the total cost take a lot more than one or two people trying to put them together, because the local people can't even give you a good example of what's going on in the other counties, and nobody's putting it together overall, because you're not you don't have national organizations doing what you think they should be doing for farmers and for hunters and for other, and that is keeping a fair and honest track of this, because they're afraid of the federal government coming down on them. A lot of
okay, Jim, I'm going to hold this for discussion again. I want to come back and finish this thing. So we've talked pretty much about energy and food. I'm going to kind of skip through these now. Timber, you mentioned the spotted owl has wiped out timber industry in Northern California, Southern Oregon, and that's probably, I'm sure there's examples across the nation of that. Talk just briefly about what the risk is to home ownership.
The critical habitat designation in my opinion, it's a very unconstitutional thing. They can take without compensation. And when they say that's critical habitat out behind your house there, Mr. McKenzie, there's nothing you can do about it, and you're not going to get any money for it. A good example of that is in Austin. It was in Austin, Texas, when they came in and they said, north of the city up there, all of that brushland out there in those hills, that's Kirtland's warbler critical habitat, because Kirtland warblers are now in danger, and they nest in there. And so you may have had land out there that you wanted to cut the brush off of and graze. You cannot do that anymore. You may have had land out there that you said, my wife and I are going to build a house out there when I retire. You can't do that anymore because you can't take that brush out of there. Or maybe you had a large bunch of land out there. You were going to cut it up into lots and sell it to people one day to put your kids through college. Could not do that anymore. Okay, and the government doesn't pay you for that. They do
okay,
not.
Okay, so all right, land takings, they control your use. Some places they don't let you put up backyard fences because of ranges and so forth. And although it doesn't specifically come under Endangered Species Act, it's kind of a close cousin. Why don't you just briefly mention about the Sackett case in the Supreme Court?
Well, that's an example of the same folks have been trying for years to expand the federal authority over navigable waterways. The federal government on the Constitution has authority over interstate and foreign commerce. So along with that, they really assumed authority at the founding of the harbors and channels up rivers to cities like up to Philadelphia or up past New Orleans, eventually all the way up to Minneapolis and the Mississippi River. That's why the Corps of Engineers does locks and keeps channels open and everything else for commerce. Well, in the last 25 or 30 years, we've seen more and more interest on the part of the people behind the Endangered Species Act and that to get the federal government to just pass a law, they think, and claim authority over all waters of the United States. A guy that didn't get reelected here in Minnesota, Jim Overstar, who'd been a congressman for years, he even introduced a law to that effect in the last Congress, and it didn't pass, and I don't think that they've got the constitutional authority to just claim that by a federal law. But be that as it may, the idea that the federal government would control all waters of the United States means not only lakes and streams and creeks and wetlands, it really means the watersheds. It means when the water's up high, when the water's low, where the water drains. It means an enormous expansion of authority. Well, they haven't had luck with that, but now the EPA, which is really it's like a bunch of hornets lately that's been kicked in their nest and just buzzing like can be, they are trying to write their regulations, as Karen Bud Fallon was talking about earlier, about the law and policies and the regs all sort of going down the road together. They're trying to write their regulations to say that they have authority over wetlands wherever they may occur and whatever they call them to be and wherever they find this plant or that plant. The Sacketts up in Idaho are a family that own half acre lot, about a block from a lake up there. They got houses all around them and some trees, and they're going to build a house on their lot. And the EPA came in and said, no, you can't do that because it's a wetland. They said, well, it's not a wetland. They said, well, we declared it a wetland. And there's no recourse for them. And the EPA said, if you try to do anything out there or you don't restore it the way we tell you to, we're going to be fining you $30,000 a day or something. And fortunately, they found a law firm that went into court to represent them, and that's now before the Supreme Court, to whether or not the federal government has this authority, number one, to say that they have authority here, but number two, that they can actually go to the landowner and say, listen, you do exactly what we say, Buster, or we're going to fine you $30,000 a day, and there's no hearings for you, you don't have any recourse, just us, and by the way, we're too busy to answer your phone calls.
Okay, well, I'm going to jump in, Jim, because I'm going to wrap up this segment here. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'm going to wrap this up here. So the point I wanted to make here was that, you know, private property is being threatened here. Home ownership is being threatened. I suppose the reason this was declared a wetland is the sack has left the sprinklers on too long. Terry, would you like to ask a few questions and jump in? Terry, are you there? Terry, if you're talking,
I am,
you're on mute.
I am now. I thought I unmuted, but I'm muted.
Okay,
thank you, Kirk.
Go.
You know me, Kirk. I kind of like to shift the thinking a little bit, and sometimes that throws off the game plan a little bit or throws off the discussion, but I think it's important. We get, you know, it's important because for us to look at the details of what really is an exoteric agenda in that, you know, the people are feeling the pain of what they perceive to be unjust abuse of the government or things that look stupid to them or, you know, this sort of thing. But we fail often to really see the undercurrent of the flow that's behind the scenes. It's really an esoteric agenda that's really driving all this other stuff, all these details, all of these violations, all of these things that they're laying claim to. And, you know, when you start looking at the way the government deals, like with the tribes and foreign entities and the way they manipulate things behind the scenes, then you can begin to get that picture. We are blessed with a gracious host of Dr. Kate here who has worked, you know, she's had her face in that whole arena. She's been literally targeted because of the knowledge that she's got. And I think it would really be good for you, Kate, to bring out a little bit of your knowledge at this point and maybe interact some with Jim and Karen and Ray.
Oh, well, thank you, Terry. I really appreciate it. And I don't want to, like you, I don't want to throw the discussion off, but you may or may not know, I know maybe some of the audience knows, but I've spent about 26 years of my career working in Indian country and basically just got unceremoniously booted out of that whole field because of what I know about natural resources, about how the tribes are being used, about the agenda of supposedly, you know, new tribal regulations and tribal government, which is really about UN Agenda 21 and how the tribes are being used against rural land owners. Now, I know I've worked with National Marine Fisheries Service. I've done work in there with tribes. I've worked in the Interior Department with the Office of the Secretary and all on the inside of the Endangered Species Act in Indian Country, as well as EPA and its supposed support of tribal sovereignty through the passage of regulations and so forth. And this is perhaps not the subject of this show, but I wanted to make myself available to talk at any time about this because it is particularly alarming. Now, I spent 2010 in North Dakota supposedly working on an Indian water rights settlement right up there in the Bakken Formation. And, you know, the three affiliated tribes of over a million acres sit right on top of the center of the Bakken Formation, which means the greatest amount of oil that's there, as well as all the water that's there. And what I saw was, frankly, the Chinese being used and influenced, the tribes basically being bought off for the development and the ruination of their opportunities in exchange for funding support from the Chinese government and Agenda 21. Now, you wonder why the Keystone Pipeline went down. Well, you've got to ask that question about what the tribe's role is in that. So I just wanted to throw that out. Also, having the experience of working within these agencies, you know, with the exception of people like Jim and others, there really is not that much expertise. I saw, for example, the grabbing of whole watersheds for a singular species without the necessary scientific legs underneath that grabbing For example, how can you have in the National Marine Fisheries Service, where I worked, only one hydrologist when the Secretary's responsibility under the Endangered Species Act is to determine what the species need? Well, they're not doing that. This is, as you said, really being guided by the attorneys and by these esoteric policies, but I can affirm for you that the tribal role in here is big, and it's not something that they naturally know, but it is a very dangerous piece, and they are being used against rural landowners. So, I mean, all this to say, I've been listening very intently here and putting in various comments, and perhaps we should have another show on this, on how they actually are interacting here, but this is a very dangerous, dangerous piece about the Endangered Species Act, about all EPA regulations, and how they're moving this forward. So, Terry, I'm sorry to just jump in with all of that, but you know, I've got a lot of experience here, and like I said, I lost my career over what I know about Indians and energy development and water, and I'm anxious to find a way to assist rural landowners in this issue. Thanks, Terry.
You're welcome. Jim, would you like to follow-up comment to that?
No, I have noticed in the last 11 years since I left the federal government, and I've been doing a lot of speaking and a lot of just kind of minor consulting work, trying to help little groups here, irrigators here and dog owners there and others that are up against these federal bureaucrat laws, how I'm struck by how so few of us know about the other guys or gals' problems and how much they've profited, the federal government has, in expanding the taking authority under the Endangered Species Act, for instance, or expanding the way that they push the states out of the way, because most of us say, well, I don't care about Indian land up there in Montana. What do I care about that? Or I don't have any dogs, so what do I care about the wolves killing dogs? Or I don't raise any cattle. What's the big deal about losing a few calves? And, you know, same with the loggers. You know, what do I care about the spot at all? None of us really share as much as you're doing right here. And in a large way, and the media doesn't cover these things in any kind of an honest and forthright manner, and we sort of are all isolated in our own little areas of the country, our own little narrow interests, and it's that old business, you know, I mean, that old World War II saying about, you know, when they came for the Jews, what did I care, I wasn't a Jew, when they came for the Protestants, what did I care, I wasn't a Protestant, when they came for me, nobody was there. That's exactly what's going on all across this country with the way in which most of us here now are Westerners that are talking on this phone, but look, we know very little or nothing about what happened with the ivory-billed woodpecker, what's going on with the Florida panther, or how the black bear is being used in Louisiana and Florida to both do away with hunting and also to, you know, impede agricultural development and just a whole range of things. And we need to put this together and come together to react to it. And unless we can, we're just a bunch of isolated little bands here and there that can just be swept aside very easily.
Well, I'd also like for Red to jump in here, because this is actually, you know, Red's been very close to the timber and mining industries and things like that throughout his life, and he's from Montana originally, and I'd like to hear, Red, what your thoughts are at this point.
Well, what I would contribute at this point is the fact that all of this problem that we have with all these bureaucracies and such is because we, the people, as individuals, we lost our sovereignty. We gave it up. We were not taught in our lives how to act as sovereigns. And I have told the story in the past of the rancher in Montana, northwest Montana, who 20 years ago almost shot a grizzly. And, of course, he didn't shoot, shovel, and shut up. He was very proud of himself and bragging about it. And of course, they arrested him. And they prosecuted him in federal court in Great Falls, Montana, for killing this endangered grizzly bear. And it didn't take the jury very long, and they came out and said not guilty. That was the end of that right there. Now, if I was in Montana and I was ranching yet at this point in time, I would, if I saw a wolf, I would delist that wolf because I'd kill him right on the spot because I would be protecting my own property. And if they prosecuted me, I'd take my chances at being able to educate the jury. Because it's happening in Montana. People are regaining their sovereignty. And what that means is that they recognize that they are the ones who enforce the Constitution. The Constitution has turned into almost nothing because we the people aren't enforcing it. And we are the ones that have to enforce it. People have a problem. They just can't seem to sort things out, and so they're told that the U.S. Supreme Court is the highest court in the land. The highest court is not the U.S. Supreme Court. That is made up of nine government agents. All of them have a conflict of interest. If it's a conflict or a controversy between a citizen and the government, those nine justices are government agents, and they really don't have any authority whatever to determine the facts of the case because they have a very serious conflict of interest. And so I think that we've got to go at this from a different angle if we're going to solve this problem, and that is we've got to get the American people to recognize that we, the people, are the sovereigns. When we sit on a jury, we don't have to take orders from the judge or the prosecutor. We're supposed to protect our fellow American and protect them from the endangered species idiots out there. And I'm going to finish with just a little bit of a humor here. I had a contractor come out and I've got to have a culvert put in, and I had a contractor come and take a look at it. And I know this fellow. I've had him do work for me before. And he told me, he said, I just got off of a job, a government job here in Washington State. And he said he was being paid by the hour on this job. And he said they would get orders that told him, you come to work tomorrow at 8:06 in the morning. And another day it'd be 8:01 or 8:10 or whatever. And he said, well, you know, he'd never been on a job where they told him such odd hours. They had 8 to 5 or something, you know. And so he asked them what in the world was going on. They said, oh, it's the mating season for the spotted owls. And we have it calculated out that we don't want to disturb them with this construction project. So that's why the different time. And, of course, I had a good laugh over it. And because this is the ridiculousness of what we've got, because there's spotted owls, lots and lots of them out here in Washington where I'm at right now. There's no shortage of spotted owls. I have a younger brother that was he's a retired forester. He was a district ranger. And when the spotted owl thing came along, him and two other of the older fellows went back, took their own time, their vacation time, their own money, flew back to Washington, D.C., and tried to tell Congress what was going on. And as a result, they didn't like what he was doing. They retired him 2 years earlier than he was due because they wanted to get him out of sight. They promised him his full retirement, and that's what he did because he knew that they was going to give him a hard time. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that's going on, and it's just got to stop.
You know, Red, could I just real quickly back up what you said and ask everyone that's listening to think about the costs of that job that Red just discussed, the cost of doing whatever it was they were doing, the construction, the fact that it took longer and everything and the quality that it was done, and think about all of these endangered species and what they're doing to all kinds of costs to rural Americans, to the forest industry, the agricultural industry, to the development of our energy. The costs are not in anywhere gathered up, and they're absolutely enormous. Everything from these little lizards and darters up to wolves and free-roaming buffalo and jaguar fences down along the border. It's just horrendous what this is doing to this country, and nowhere is it brought together for everyone to understand. I wish we all could come up with a way to bring this to everybody's attention in an understandable way, but it's just so much bigger than any of us really realize.
Karen, I know that you worked in Washington, D.C. for a while. Why don't you tell us about your experience with the mindset and the skill set back there?
Certainly. My working in D.C. was a very interesting experience. I went there right out of undergraduate school, so I grew up in a town of 500 people, went to the University of Wyoming, which had 20,000 kids at the time. I got a job working for Jim Watt, who was Secretary of the Interior in Washington, D.C. I worked for the Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management, and one of my first tasks was working on grazing regulations related to livestock grazing on BLM land. I often tell the story that during that time, I got to know one of the attorneys that was also working on those regulations. The guy was a very bright attorney, had graduated from Howard University, which is a very fine law school back in Washington, D.C. He was with the honors program, so he graduated very high in his class. But the guy was from Cleveland. The guy had never been west of Cleveland. And so here he is writing grazing regulations that are going to affect public lands grazing, including my father and his ranch in Big Piney, Wyoming, and the guy had never seen a cow. And when I talked about the ranch and I talked about Wyoming to him, the ranch that I grew up on, which was a very modest ranch, was all of the land in Wyoming, because his mindset was based on living in an apartment building in Cleveland and moving to Washington, D.C. And so even if you were to think that this guy had good intentions and was very smart in the law, he had no concept of how what he was writing was going to affect people who were on the ground trying to make a living with those regulations. And it was really fascinating to me to see how Washington, D.C. thinks that these one-size-fit-all regulations and one-size-fit-all policies are going to work in places like Big Piney, Wyoming, or Siskiyou County, California. And quite frankly, given the differences between those two areas, I don't think the same policies would even work in those two areas, let alone if you take it down and then try to apply it in Lordsburg, New Mexico. It's just too different, and we've got to get away from this mindset that Washington knows everything and really work on getting local governments and local citizens involved, because we're the ones that know what's going on out on the ground, not very well-educated people in D.C. who have never been out and seen a cow or seen a grazing allotment or have any understanding of what it's really like to make a living out here.
What's their attitude towards rural Americans?
They have no understanding. They think that food comes from a grocery store. They think that it rains all the time. So when Dr. Kate talks about her knowledge of water rights, understanding water rights in the West is absolutely key, because without water, you don't have property. And the concept and the systems are so different from state to state that you can't just assume one size fits all. And I think we've really made a mistake in this country, because we seem to think that food is just going to magically show up on grocery store shelves, when people in the urban areas have to understand that not only does rural America supply open space, we are the ones that are supplying your food. We are the ones that supply energy. We are the ones that supply minerals for electric lines or for the wire in your house. And so it's not just a matter of it's nice to think rural America is out there. You need us, and you need to support us so that, that you can continue to have your goods and services in the city.
Dr. Kate, you had some experience in Washington, D.C. What would you say their perspective is of rural Americans?
Oh, sorry. I agree with Karen. It's just, it's, they have no concept. I'm just going to use an example with the Clean Water Action Plan. And also the Missouri River flooding this year, which I thought was atrocious and was intentional. But, you know, the Clean Water Action Plan was this government-wide initiative, like watersheds just came on to people's minds, and finally they realized about water and the way it works and so forth. But the perspective was more for how can we control that water and the water quality, absolutely irrespective of what was being produced on the land and what, in fact, Western watersheds produce for people. The whole flooding of the Missouri River this summer is another example where the policy drivers in Washington absolutely ignored the physical need to evacuate the reservoirs like any hydrologist would evacuate reservoirs. Instead, there was a policy directive to try to enable extra water developed on federal watersheds through cloud seeding and so forth, landing in the reservoirs all the way down the Missouri, and as opposed to protecting the people and the lands and the agricultural crops and so forth in the Missouri, some bureaucrat had the great idea that they could use a portion of the Flood Control Act to try to sell that surplus water that was generated not on federal lands, generated on private lands throughout the West, and they could sell that surplus water to everybody in the states who were there while they continued to meet the barging interests downstream. So we all know what happened in the Missouri and the flooding that was there, and the Army, I saw those discussions. I was a part of the Missouri River Recovery Implementation Plan, the big ESA activities on the Missouri for a while. I was representing a tribal government there on a 72-member committee. And the idea was outrageous. You know, after the Missouri River floods, while everyone was trying to recover, you know, the environmental community was thrilled because it redistributed the sandbars in the river. But we've got now big gouged out sections of the Missouri that are going to take a long time to recover. And, of course, there was, with the kind of cloud seeding weather modification that was going on, it ruined everybody's crops. And it was outrageous. The Army would be able to do various things according to what the Fish and Wildlife Service wants, but everything would be wiped out or changed every year with the operating plan. So I sat in several hearings where the Army was trying to basically sell the surplus water to rural users and to cities and towns in North Dakota and South Dakota. In the meantime, all the South Dakota water managers and North Dakota water managers were saying, excuse me, when are you going to evacuate the reservoirs so we can have some flood protection, which is what the Flood Control Act was all about. So, again, the policymakers in D.C. have no concept, and there is always another agenda. And I personally believe that the agenda in the Missouri this year was to really destroy the food supply and to ruin the system for everybody. And so I am very alarmed by that. I remember sitting in several meetings where, you know, these kind of environmental tricks, if you will, because I was in D.C. during a Democratic, during the Clinton administration. So it was alarming to see not only the manipulation of science, but the design of policy to really cripple the West. And so, long way of saying, I agree with Karen. You may be the brightest person in law school and so forth, but you have no concept of what a watershed really even is. They think regulation, they think control, they mask it under, you know, loving the environment. And in fact, what it does is it ruins Americans' livelihood. So I am quite alarmed when I see, especially on the scale of the Missouri River flooding this year, very alarmed at the policy implications, and have wanted to write an article that I would, I guess, call the forensic hydrology of the Missouri River floods in 2011. It was just outrageous. So
I get the sense that the people in Washington, D.C. are not only not qualified, but they have an arrogance that they believe they're smarter than the people in rural America. So I'm going to throw that in. Neither of you mentioned it, but I believe that's a factor here. I want to bring Ray back into the conversation here. Ray,
I might add one more thing. I don't think that the technical expertise is that good in the regions either, and particularly with regard to EPA. And I don't know if it's because there are a lot of East Coast people in these Western areas, but I'm really also alarmed, very alarmed at that. I do not see expertise where it should be, and where it needs to be. And so, therefore, everything does get driven then by policy and not necessarily common sense. Thanks.
Okay. So let me, Ray, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I'll toss you a specific question, then kind of open it up for you to make some general observations on this whole conversation. What does it actually take to list an animal? What is the process, what is the decision-making process they go through in deciding to list an animal as an endangered species?
That's to me?
Yeah.
Well, you know, in general, I know it. Jim probably knows better than I do, but basically, you know, there's a petition to list based on the species population dwindling or its habitat dwindling. And, you know, I can't speak to the initial intent of the law, but I know most recently what there's an effort to go out and find the most obscure species that there's very little information known about. Listing then, or the petition to list, there's always a threat of a suit to sue if you don't list. So I think the service is going through a dance just like everybody else, of trying to avoid some litigation, and often ends up trying to justify why it shouldn't be listed with no information to even defend themselves. So a lot of species get listed in that way. Is that what you're kind of after, Kurt?
Well, I think that Karen or Jim, maybe you can add to this. Perhaps let me direct it to Karen a bit. Maybe you could jump in. My understanding is that the threshold for listing is anybody can file a request, which has to be responded to, and so now we're getting thousands of these things. And secondarily, it's largely a paper. They study the papers, the research papers out there. It's not like they go out in the field and start counting animals or anything like that. They do a paper search type thing.
No, that's exactly right. Yes. To get a species on the list, all you have to do is write a letter to the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Fish and Wildlife Service is then required within 90 days to review that letter and determine if further study is warranted. If the Fish and Wildlife Service does not file a finding within 90 days, the case can go to litigation and attorney's fees can be paid. The Fish and Wildlife Service then has a year to determine whether the species ought to be considered for placing on the list. One of the most amazing things I found about the Endangered Species Act is it does not require anyone to actually go out and count the number of species that are out there. Rather, the Fish and Wildlife Service does a literature search based on the, quote, best scientific evidence available. And if they feel like there used to be more species then than there are now, that's enough to list the species. And so they don't even have to know how many species that there are at the current time. The courts have further modified that to say that even if you have numerous species out there, enough species that the species itself will get going, if the habitat of the species is shrinking or getting smaller, then the species can be listed, which is exactly what you were getting at the beginning of the show, where you have buffalo, for example, which are part of the multi-species ESA litigation. The buffalo have to be considered for listing as part of that settlement agreement. While there are thousands of buffalo, and we can raise buffalo in captivity, the question for the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be is are they in the same habitat and in the same places that they were before? And certainly the answer is no, because you now have cities in places where you used to have plains. And so the question is going to be, should we list the buffalo?
Yeah. I think people have to understand the implications. You're talking North Dakota, South Dakota, I don't know, three or four states opening that up. I mean, it truly is the destruction of civilization really across the country. Ray, you've been awfully quiet through a lot of this conversation, and you've probably had some thoughts or questions.
Well, just some thoughts. It's interesting, the dynamic and talk about the East Coast. You know, I worked on the East Coast for a little while. I'm actually from the East Coast, left Pennsylvania when I was 14. There's an interesting play that goes on that I observed in the politics between the East and West Coast with environmental groups and with the general public. The East Coast is told that there's nothing left on the West Coast, for which a lot of the population believes that from either a timber perspective or a habitat perspective. And on the West Coast, the West Coast doesn't even pay much attention to the East Coast kind of thing. So there's a divide propaganda war that goes on I think is a major source of some of the funding strains that come from the East Coast to the West, this paranoia, so to speak, about the disappearance of forest. I'm just as fascinated listening as I am talking, to tell you the truth, because one of the things that I've focused a lot of my time on, and probably in the last 10 years, is more the social engineering that goes on with the implications of the application of some of these laws or regulations, mainly because of the court precedent that's set. So I've spent a great deal of time trying to figure out motive and players and where this was all going. So, you know, when you bring up like Agenda 21, I was one of the first around here that was even talking about it in Siskiyou County, because I spent some time researching it, and some of the groups that focus on using that as a vehicle to create what would be called sometimes willing sellers of land around here, and I see that agenda being played out before my eyes in a big way right now in Siskiyou County.
Jim, do you have some further comments?
Well, I don't have any further comments other than to say that I find myself thinking that so many people look on the listing process, Washington, D.C., as a bunch of choir boys and girls, and what I know of them and what I've seen of them, when we talk about the way things are listed, I don't think of them that way at all. I think of them as a pretty crooked bunch, and I don't mean that individually or criminally, but I use the example occasionally when I give a talk about people asking me about that. Hey, Mr. Beers, it sounds like you don't have any respect for the people in Washington. And it's not so much that. I use the example of, I said, you're all familiar with EEO programs, you know, women, minorities in these jobs, and we need more of them, and we're going to keep track of them, blah, 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 and all this. I said, imagine for a moment if somebody would have come out and said, you know, we don't have any Quakers in the Defense Department, and we really need to do more for Quakers in the Defense Department. And you really started hiring Quakers. You started promoting them real quick. You started taking Quakers and putting them in top jobs and boasting about it, blah, 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 and all this. I submit that within a few years, you would see a different kind of Defense Department, a different attitude towards interventions or raiding pirates or, you know, invasions or advice to the president. You'd see a very different kind of Defense Department. That's what you've got right now with your Interior Department, Secretary of Lands and Waters, and what you've got for the last 20 years with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service and the BLM. You've got top people and career people that have hired, promoted, and embedded outside of the political process, depending on, you know, what kind of, like, this administration's a lot greener than the last one and all that stuff. Outside of that, you've got in there solid environmentalists that believe we shouldn't cut trees, we shouldn't put out fires, we shouldn't be killing animals. Animal rights people that think that we ought to be giving these animals back everything we took for them, and all of us burrowing into two or three condominiums somewhere in the, on the East Coast, I guess, near a port. But they really believe those things, and they're writing regulations and meeting with their soulmates in the Center for Biological Diversity, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Humane Society of the United States, and talking about routinely these issues we're talking about. And they talk and plot things, and I don't mean they plot it in a way that makes them criminals so much as they're doing it in what they feel is the right thing to do. It's almost like a religious calling, and that's what you've got driving this train off of the tracks and over the side of the cliff right now. And
I think that I'd like to jump in on this particular point. I think that the there are some really environmental extremists. I really believe their agenda is not even environmental. It really is much different than that. I think they're subversives. But I think that the one of the issues that confronts rural America is people like live in the urban areas, the suburban areas. You know, we have this picture of a pretty forest. We have a picture of a pretty stream. And we have in our mind the idea that the environmental movement and legislation coming out of that is basically well-intended, it's good for us. And, you know, I don't think that they have really awakened to the fact that the movement has been hijacked. Ray and I have been working on a timeline here, and I think in my own mind, here's a couple of key timelines for people to consider. In 1962, Rachel Carson published a book called Silent Spring, and I was in that era. I think many of us were and probably know the impact of that book. There was a environmental consciousness waking across the country that, hey, we do care about our planet. We do want to do right by it. You know, Sea Care Club and all those kind of things are formed, and we do care. And it was in the context of an honest effort, I think, to make sure that we didn't destroy our planet. Then in 1967, comes out another book called Report from Iron Mountain, and in there, it's a leaked government report, allegedly, whereby the people that are the thinkers that are asked to participate in this, who are not named in the report, are posed the question, how do you justify government in a time of peace? The idea being that the only reason that people, you know, even support government at all is under threat of security, and therefore, if you don't have that threat, well, gosh, how do you justify government? And in that book, it analyzes various alternatives that come close as possible to the same thing as war. And one of those was considered to be an environmental crisis. Then in 1973, we have the Endangered Species Act come out. And then in 1977 comes out another interesting publication. It is a task force that is funded by the Rockefeller family, who, in my opinion, is one of the families that are behind all of these things. And essentially, it's a team of people, which we can now call stakeholders, and they, in my opinion, are essentially taking the public consciousness about the environment and basically co-opting it and taking it over and turning it into political movement without the public's knowledge. And this report actually kind of lays out the plans that they have had and the thinking behind all this thing. Although it's couched in pretty words like Agenda 21 is, it's really underneath the whole thing is a central control world government kind of philosophy. That particular report, for those who want it, is on the defendruralamerica.com website. If you go to the tab called Get Involved, it's one of the tabs that's on that website, and you do a search of the text through here. It's a short page. Look for the one called The Unfinished Agenda, The Citizen's Policy Guide to Environmental Issues. I think that'll show you where really a lot of this thinking comes from, and a lot of the organizations that we're fighting in this battle are, in fact, the people that are generating that report, in my opinion, the basis of their strategy and how they're going to take this environmental movement and use it as a way to taking centralized control. So everybody should go ahead and download a copy of that report. Terry, do you have some thoughts at this point?
Well, yes, I do. We've got about 15 minutes left, and again, you know me, I like to take it to a different level, and as Dr. Cade has suggested, I put a question in our chat, our program chat tonight to our listeners about where in the Constitution are these authorities to make environmental laws delegated to the federal government? And I'd like to pose that question to each one of our guests.
Well, why don't we start with Karen, because Karen, being an attorney and well-versed in the Constitution, Karen, perhaps you could start that.
The Constitution does not say anything about reserving or delegating authority to the federal government to make environmental laws. It is simply not in there. The way that the federal government has gotten away with all of this is through the Commerce Clause. When you look at the Constitution, the Founding Fathers set up this country so that the federal government would have very limited powers. But one of the powers that the Founders gave was to protect interstate commerce, commerce between two states. They didn't want people building, you know, dams across the Mississippi River. They wanted the states to be able to trade with foreign countries as a group. And so the Founding Fathers put the Commerce Clause in the Constitution. The problem is the courts have taken the Commerce Clause and applied it to everything, including the Endangered Species Act. There have been numerous constitutional challenges to the Endangered Species Act, claiming that the regulations and that the act is simply outside the authority of the Constitution. And what the courts have said is that because somehow or the other, an endangered species may affect interstate commerce, including the last challenge was the protection of Cape bugs in Texas, that the law was constitutional. I have to tell you, I do not agree with the Supreme Court on that issue. I don't think the Founding Fathers intended the Commerce Clause to be read anywhere close to as broadly as the Supreme Court is reading it now. But that's what the courts have determined, and that's why we are still living under the Endangered Species Act.
What's a cave bug?
Little tiny bugs that live in dark caves in Texas that never see the light of day, let alone ever cross state lines.
Sounds like an OBOT. I have a question, and my question's for Red Beckman. Red, if you were on a grand jury and somebody was brought up under charges in federal environmental laws, how would you vote as a juror whether you would indict or not indict or whether you would convict or not convict, and why? Red? Red may not be there. Did Red drop off, Kate? Or am I not hearing well?
No, Red dropped. There he is. Let's see if he's back. Yep, let me get him back on. There he is. Go ahead, Red.
Yeah. If I was on that grand jury, I would say that this individual is not guilty of a crime, and I would start asking some questions of those who have brought the charges against the individual. You know, grand juries have such a tremendous amount of power. And, you know, these people that are promoting all of this off-the-wall type of stuff, if they were brought before a grand jury and had to answer the question, who is paying? Who is putting up the money for all of this? And, you know, I told about my brother, the forester, going to Washington, D.C. They had to use their own money and everything else, and the people in Washington would not listen. Somebody was paying them not to pay any attention to the truth. They were being paid. It was, you know, it was a cut and dry deal. They were getting paid to do what they wanted to do. What the powers that be were trying to instill into this country. And it's just the grand juries, if they were functioning with sovereign citizens sitting on those grand juries, we wouldn't be there where we're at today with all the trillions of dollars of debt and all of that. If they were doing their job, but what is happening, the public education system has shortchanged, I don't know how many generations, four or five at least, and they've not been taught one word about how an individual is to be sovereign, how he is to exercise his sovereignty on grand juries and on petit juries. Those are separate powers, and they were put there so that the people could be a check against the Congress, a check against the courts, a check against the executive branch of government. And we've lost it because we haven't been taught, and we're going to have to go back and start over again and start teaching this. I've been at it for a long time, and I don't know where the rest of you were, but I first got on the soapbox in 1975. And, you know, I knew before that what was happening, but I didn't get on the soapbox until 1975 when I really became concerned about what was going on. And so the sovereignty of the citizens, what I would recommend that is everybody on this panel tonight, read the 7th article of the Bill of Rights. They don't teach the 7th article of the Bill of Rights in law school. Our lawyers, our young lawyers, our students in law school are being shortchanged. I've talked to many, many lawyers, and I've not had one that ever had any kind of instruction on the 7th Amendment. The 7th Amendment is the most important of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights because that's where the sovereignty of the individual, the sovereignty of the people, comes out, because a 7th Amendment common law jury trial, this is what we're missing in our justice system. Due process of law is not available today because people, lawyers and the people, don't know about the common law and how it's supposed to work. It took me years to figure this thing out, and now I've seen it work. We've done something with the tax court that's never been done before, just by using the 7th article of the Bill of Rights, and it's Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure provide for common law actions, and this is what we're going to have to go to. And of course, the jury. My goodness, the IRS has become a domestic government-sponsored terrorist organization, because we the people were sitting on juries and we were giving them the power to terrorize. And we don't have to put up with that. And after teaching this in Montana back there in 1979, the IRS was winning every case. In 1980, they lost 4 out of 5 in the federal courts. They couldn't even get an indictment out of a grand jury for about 4 years out of the decade of the 80s. Now, we need to teach the American people these simple principles. We're going to have to keep them simple, because they're not going to they're not going to understand what you're talking about if you get too fancy with your language and all that. You got to be right down to earth at their level where they can understand what you're talking about. But I'd recommend that every one of you take that 7th Amendment and read it.
Yeah, let me read it to the. It's not that long. It suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Now, there tells you that the courts, no court in the land, including the U.S. Supreme Court, they cannot tamper with the verdict, the evidence that the jury has had, and the courts cannot tamper with it. The grand or the Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in our land. But
what's
how
your
many Americans
of,
know about that?
What's your definition of common law?
Common law is common law, and it just means you use the common sense. You use the Ten Commandments, and the common law is not codified. It's not, you know, people have a sense of what is right and what is wrong, and we have to cultivate that. And it's the people have been deprived of common sense. There's just no common sense available out there to pass on to the next generation.
Terry, this is Jim Beers. Can I make a quick comment about the basis for federal government environmental law?
I was going to invite you to do so.
All right, just real quickly, back at the turn of the last century, when we started buying Park Service lands, Forest Service lands, setting them aside like Yellowstone, which, by the way, was never in Wyoming, so that's kind of unique. It's a federal enclave, unlike the other ones. But anyway, the Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM lands, they all started getting regulations on them because they had a federal ownership, but they didn't pay taxes. They paid, they shared receipts, as Ray mentioned earlier. But that's gone by the wayside because they've grown in such power that they no longer figure they have to cut the timber, that they have to graze the grass and give any money to local people. They don't even have to answer to them. But anyhow, that was the beginning of it with the federal lands. And then we had the animal damage control in and around those federal lands and then on other lands, particularly in the West. So they had animal damage control, federal laws. But the biggie was in 1917, we signed a treaty with Canada, actually with Britain on behalf of Canada at the time, for a bunch of migratory birds, 200 species that we put on a list. When we signed that treaty, that migratory bird treaty, brought it home, President signed it, Senate passed it, it comes under Article 6 of the Constitution, which says all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. So that gave all authority over those species, mostly ducks and geese, with quite a few songbirds too, to the federal government. When we had that big avalanche of environmental awareness in the 1960s and 70s, and they were passing Marine Mammal Protection Act, and they were passing all these other things to protect everything, we started signing UN treaties and conventions because we learned, the environmentalists learned, that a treaty was a very, very powerful thing for the hunters, for the duck and goose killers that wanted to keep shooting them. And they wanted to use that authority for all things. So they started signing treaties for the protection of endangered species and other things, and they call them conventions and treaties. And we started working close with them and trying to get things ratified, kind of like the Kyoto business, which if the Senate would pass it, the President sign it, would give all kinds of new authority to the federal government. Well, that between the treaty power and the growth of the federal bureaucracies and the Park Service now and the Forest Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service have really gotten pumped up, and they just don't recognize hardly any state or county say about anything. They might as well be on the moon for all they care about the state of Montana or the state of Texas or whatever Alabama wants done with the forest down there or the cutting or the fire control or anything. They've become so removed that they're like a tyranny, like a dictatorship, and that's the right words, not just for the agencies or the people running them, but for the whole federal government and the people that are in those jobs right now as far as what they're going to do in the West or even what they want to do in Maine with wolves or what they want to do with the panther down in Florida. They use those things as tools to just take more and more control out there. But that's what got them started. And I think it's one of the reasons why we've got to trim back those laws. I don't see any other answer. I really don't.
Well, it's kind of become a situation. I just want to say one thing, and then you can wrap up, Terry, if you want. It's almost become an issue of the EPA versus the Constitution, because I think that the general philosophy under the EPA now is the Constitution doesn't matter. It trumps everything, private property rights and the welfare of the nation and everything else.
Do you have time for one more quick comment?
30 seconds.
Okay. You ask about where the jurisdiction comes from. I don't believe there is jurisdiction there. In fact, I have real-life proof in a place where the Forest Service tried to regulate earthworms in Florida while I was employed there. And quickly we got a call from the Department of Justice that said that all wildlife, all fish belongs to the state, and only the state has the authority and power to regulate it. It was the intention of the Founding Fathers that that be the case so that there was no such thing as the king's wild game. And so I don't believe the federal government does have that authority.
I appreciate all of our guests tonight. We are out of time. I want to give you one thought. And that is that a state does not get its sovereignty from its territory. It gets its sovereignty from the people. And when the federal government comes in and takes things away from within a state, whether it's a constitutional delegated right or whatever, if it's a natural resource, it in essence is stealing it from the people because it does not get its, it doesn't have a right to do that because those resources and everything within that state and all of its state sovereignty comes from its people. Everybody have a great night. We'll see you next week. And guest Jim, Ray, Karen, you guys were great tonight. Thank you very much. And we definitely welcome you back here at any time. Kurt, thanks a lot for leading this discussion. Kate, Red, see you next week.